display, so. We came from a large Western university to excavate a site in a rural African community, sparsely populated by subsistence farmers and fishermen. Previous research had indicated that this now isolated location had once been a hub for international trade over 1,000 years ago. The professor leading the project hoped to uncover more evidence for this trade and to pursue leads that might indicate the trade was older than previously thought. He had a long commitment to struggles against colonialism in several African countries, and he believed that knowledge of one's history was necessary for liberation. To the Western mindset, Africa has long been a dark and isolated continent, dark except for the light provided by Western Enlightenment ideas and progress. But the professor believed that sites such as the one we came to excavate could show that the people of Africa had been closely connected with the outside world through international trade long before the European colonization of the continent. Excavations at the site 4 years before uncovered the burial of a child. The car that took the child's remains to the capital was in an accident. But nothing in Africa happens by accident, and people in the community were uneasy about our return. As a result, the professor was intent on gaining everyone's approval before beginning a new round of excavations. The professor was well known in the community, and when we first arrived, he went to the elders. We provided the elders with wine, cigarettes, and bread, and they sat in the shade of a large baobab tree, eating, drinking, and smoking, while we stood in the sun, looking on from a respectful distance. After about 30 minutes, the elders came over to us and said that they had consulted with the ancestors and that all was clear for our excavations. The professor came with a handful of students. We hired local people to excavate the site, alternating crews and excavating over large areas. Over the course of 4 weeks, we opened up house floors and uncovered ample evidence of trade with the Middle East. About halfway through the project, the professor spoke to one of the local leaders, explaining that he wanted to build a museum at the site that would include a walking tour. He wanted the museum to be there so the children of the community could learn their history from the excavations. The elder seemed uninterested in the museum, but had no problem with its construction. He asked only that all the holes be filled in when we were done, explaining that last time, 4 years before, a hole was left open, and as a result, drought had followed and the community had suffered. After excavating for a month, the professor and most of the students left, leaving myself and one student behind. We stayed on for a couple days cleaning things up. On our first night alone, we paid everyone who had worked on the project and purchased a goat. We then slaughtered the goat and had a great feast with lots of wine and rice on top of the mound from the filled-in excavations. The next night, several people invited the two of us to a celebration. We left our camp on a beautiful night with a full moon and perfectly clear skies. The air was completely still, and the moonlight cast wonderfully twisted shadows through the gnarled limbs of the baobab trees. We were brought to a cluster of huts by a lake, farther away from our camp than we had ever been before. The flames of many fires flickered like strobe lights, and several people were strewn about, passed out, drunk like the dead on a battlefield. One of the spiritual leaders that we had befriended during the previous weeks sat us down on a mat. Scores of people stopped drinking, and forming a circle began to drum and sing. One woman stood out amongst everyone else in a great grass skirt with bells around her legs and two large spears in her hands. She told everyone to sing louder and with more force, pointing to us, the two Muzungu with their spears. The drumming and singing went on all night. People would enter the circle and dance and then start to shake like a can of paint in a paint mixer before slowly stilling themselves. The spiritual leader we sat next to explained to us that the spirits of the ancestors whose homes and things we had been excavating took possession of the dancers and made them shake. After many hours, we said our goodbyes, and the next day we drove to the capital with all the artifacts of botanical samples and faunal material packed away in boxes. We left our Western universities with the best of intentions to both illustrate Africa's pre-colonial place on the international stage and to teach the people of this small community about their history. We came equipped with the tools of our Western science to unearth the story of Africa's past and then translate it so that Africans and Westerners could learn from it. But perhaps we unwittingly became ensnared in a trap of our own making, since we defined what we thought was worth knowing about their past. We wanted to show that Africa was not a dark continent, isolated from the world before Europe arrived. We wanted to show that Africa had played an international role, trading with distant partners long before Europeans colonized the continent. The problem was that we defined what was worth knowing, and we set the terms. International trade is something that we in the West understand as important. Several years ago, Henry Louis Gates Jr. narrated a popular documentary called The Wonders of Africa. What is of interest about the series in relation to this discussion is what Gates defined as the wonders of Africa. Gates's wonders provide evidence of African achievement defined through the standards that Gates shares in as a man from the West. He therefore traveled the continent, documenting the history of great African architecture, empire building, as well as evidence of great learning, libraries, and scholarship. All of these achievements are wonders, and it is important that he and other scholars illustrate their significance to a largely ignorant West, since Africa is still, for many of us, a dark continent. As Gates writes on a webpage for the documentary, let's face it, think of Africa and the first images that come to mind are of war, poverty, famine, and flies. How many of us really know anything at all about the truly great ancient African civilizations, which in their day were just as splendid and glorious as any on the face of the earth? Gates, like the professor I worked with, wanted to combat Western ignorance by illustrating African achievement. The problem was that the significance they illustrated was a significance defined by Western ideas of what is worthy of recognition. Why did Gates not visit the Kong or the Hadza or the Efe? Are they no less wonderful even if they have not produced any books or great cities? The problem is that by imposing standards derived from the West, these attempts to show what is wonderful about Africa could serve to only perpetuate the very darkness these scholars hope to remove. We are still interpreting and judging Africa through the lens of the West, as opposed to learning and presenting Africa on African terms. In Not Out of Africa, Mary Lefkowitz discusses Afrocentric, a revisionist history in which Western civilization, and in particular its roots in ancient Greece, were allegedly stolen from Africa. Lefkowitz presents a thorough outline of the factual errors in these conclusions, but what these attempts at a revisionist history also illustrate is how trapped within a cycle of Western significance Afrocentric scholarship can be. The scholars Lefkowitz critiques are trying to show the complexity and wealth of life in the history of Africa, but they attempt to do this through manufacturing a history based on Western concepts of significance. As a result, they merely legitimize the dominance of those values. Our quest to uncover the wonder of international trade caused us to look for certain things in the ground where we hoped to find evidence of that trade. We then wanted to use that knowledge to teach the people of Africa and the West that Africans were indeed wonderful, since they had long been actors on the international stage. All of this is valid and important, but we fail to acknowledge the deep connection to the past that existed amongst the very people we hired to excavate the site and within whose community we worked. These people showed us that they had a very active connection to their own past through their rituals and traditions. They consulted their ancestors to ensure it was all right for us to excavate. At the conclusion of our project, the spirits of their ancestors took possession of people within the community. And so why did we fail to acknowledge their living connection to their past and learn from it? Why did we insist on imposing our own concepts of significance? One evening after dinner, while working at the site, the professor explained to me that he could not understand how some of his archaeologist friends could claim to pursue a scientific discipline like archaeology and yet still say they believed in a god. How could they live with the contradiction of the rational and the irrational? Actually, I took out a line here that my wife told me to take out, which is, I first told him, I don't think archaeology is a science, but you said, Niels, you can't say that in this conference. But anyway, I'll put it back in. I won't tell Laura. Anyway, so I told him that I saw no contradiction between my faith and my pursuit of a scientific understanding of the world I lived in. Perhaps because faith is both a blessing and a burden, and that it can accomplish the impossible. This apparent contradiction has never been an issue for me. But the professor refused to accept that anyone could live with such a contradiction. Recently, I've had conversations with biblical literalists that are the exact flip side of the same coin. These creationists refuse to accept the existence of any contradiction for fear that their faith may disappear if it was found to be irrational, as though God was somehow tied to their Western logic. As I look back on my conversation with the professor, I wonder why I was not allowed to live the contradiction of faith and science, and yet we requested the permission of the elders, permission that they could only grant after consulting with the spirits of their ancestors. Although highly unlikely, considering the amount of money that we were bringing into the community, what if the elders had come back and said that the ancestors were unhappy and did not want us there? Would we have canceled all our plans? It was a long way from Europe. Why did we subject ourselves to the irrational whim of ancestor spirits? Perhaps we fail to acknowledge and learn from these living connections with the past because we remain so focused on our artifacts. The scientific interpretation of the artifacts and the international trade that they reflected was what we understood. To open ourselves to other ideas about the past might open us to things we could not make sense of, and we would therefore invite contradiction. Perhaps this resistance to contradiction was a sign of fear, a fear of having the rug pulled out from under us. Because of our refusal to accept contradiction, we cut ourselves off, leaving ourselves to discover and rediscover the wonders that we set out to find. The modern writer Thomas More, not the 16th century English saint, writes that we should honor the contradictions in our lives. He does not advocate that we must find a balance or accommodate difference to create equality between different sides that can be measured quantitatively. Rather, we must accept contradictions without trying to solve them. I have personally found this the key to a happy married life. It is through the acceptance of contradiction that we can collide without clashing, thereby enhancing the knowledge of everyone. According to Moore, a rich life of the soul comes not from solutions, since ultimately there are no solutions, but rather from reflection on and then acceptance of the contradictions, and that, as Moore writes, the soul finds its fertility in its irrationalities. But acceptance takes great courage, and listening requires humility. Acceptance is not about bringing together and reconciling different worldviews, since such an attempt would be an injustice to all involved. Joe Watkins defines indigenous archaeology as archaeology developed with control and influence of indigenous populations. But I'm uncomfortable with the use of the word control, since control might only result in the pendulum swinging from one extreme to the other, and there can be a fine line between control and manipulation. Rather, acceptance requires a discussion rather than accommodation. Accommodation is the process of doing what is necessary to receive permission, but then proceeding with the work as planned. Successful dialogue is the process of letting go and accepting contradiction without trying to solve the contradiction. Dialogue in our discipline requires that we place archaeology within the context of a much larger human endeavor. Through this dialogue, archaeology becomes not just the study of material culture, but the study of people. As Brady McGuire wrote about almost 20 years ago, we need to see our discipline as a study of people, not just things, but people with the present and a future as well as the past. But to move beyond our material-centered approach to the past, we should integrate our research with other aspects of culture. Several times on hikes and walks with my dad, he has commented on how well I can find odd things on the ground. I joke that that is what I do as an archaeologist. I find odd bits of garbage on the ground. Only by breaking with our dependence on material remains of a culture can we realize the humanistic potential of which archaeology is certainly capable. Through letting go and becoming inclusive versus exclusive, we can broaden our archaeological imagination and expand the structure of archaeological method and theory. We can move beyond our eco-determinist and materially driven interpretation of the indigenous past and find new relevance. In my abstract, I mentioned the story of Peter walking on the water. In the story, Peter and the other apostles see Jesus walking towards them on the water. Some of the apostles think that they are seeing a ghost, but Peter sees that it is Jesus, and being Peter, he gets out of the boat and starts to walk on the water as well. Through the strength of his faith, he was able to accept the contradiction. People cannot walk on water. It is impossible. But he accepted the impossible, was able to overcome his fear, and then do the impossible. But then he snapped out of it. He realized what he was doing and that he was living and that what he was living was irrational. He became afraid and he began to sink. In my trip to Africa, I failed to acknowledge the world that was there because I came equipped to find the world I came from. As a result, I lost an opportunity to learn something different and new. If we permit ourselves to lose our fears and to let go, permitting ourselves to accept the contradictions that we encounter, we can do the impossible and walk on water. Our lives and the lives of others will become richer if we do. Thank you.